Today is Wednesday, October 14, 2020. This is a Part 7 Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Kurt Sauer, S-A-U-E-R. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Kurt. How are you today?
Morning, Tom. I'm doing well. I hope you are too.
Very much so. Thank you. May we have your permission to record this interview over the phone?
Yes.
Thank you. We had been talking after we turned the tape off the last interview, and you had told me a story about John McCain. I wonder if you could tell me that story again.
Well, shortly after I started working for the river unit, one of my jobs was to drive one of the trucks when the crew went up to launch and then drive it back. So I was up at Lee's Ferry, and Marv Jensen said, hey, you got to go up to Page and pick up the passenger that's going on our river trip with us. I said, okay. And he said, his name's John McCain, Congressman John McCain.
Who?
And I went, okay, like, the head of the river unit is not going Page to pick up John McCain because he's down here doing some other stuff, and the rookie on the crew gets to go to Page, Arizona, the airport, which was quite small at the time, and got to meet John McCain, and it took about an hour to drive him back down from Page to Lee's Ferry. And I just remember having a really interesting conversation with him about protecting the parks and taking care of the parks, and I just didn't understand why Page, Arizona was so beautiful, but everybody kept advertising it and wanting more people to come in, and we just sat there and listened, and agreed, and basically said, yeah, but that's what's going to happen. And so we drove down, and I was just in awe, actually, of the man that was escorting back down to the boat ramp. And I wasn't in awe because he had been a prisoner of war, and he'd been held for 5 or 7 years or however long it was. He was just an outstanding person.
Nice.
Even though he was a congressman, he listened and carried on a conversation and talked about what I wanted to talk about. And he wasn't, as I've seen with so many others over the course of the years, he wasn't, and of course there was no back seat to sit in, but he wasn't sitting in the back seat, talking on the phone, reading his briefing papers, traveled without an aide. So that was my first exposure to Congressman John McCain. And then you have a much fresher and more complete understanding of all the politics and all the legislation that was being considered at the time, forced the Park Service into providing unfettered access for the commercial river runner. But that was my first exposure to, congressmen and senators get involved. And it reminds me of one other interaction. I don't know where I was. That's probably at Olympic National Park, and mountain goats were a big issue. And I happened to have a brother-in-law who was the chief of staff for Senator Harry Reid.
Okay.
Started out as high school buddies, and then he ran the Reid's campaign manager, became chief of staff for Congressman Reid. and Senator Reid. And I was having a conversation with Rinaldo, and I was quite upset that Congress was interfering with Park Service and our management. And he said something that I always remembered. And it, Kurt, you work for the executive branch. Your job is to implement legislation passed by the legislative branch. We tell you what to do. You figure out how to do it.
Ah.
And it made me realize that, you know, there are three branches of the federal government.
Right.
They all play a role. So, yeah, we implement with the legislation that they pass, starting with the Organic Act.
Right.
And when we have the right people in Congress, we get funding to implement those programs. And when we don't, we don't get funded to implement the programs. So,
good point.
Yeah. So,
You mentioned that Marv Jensen sent you up to pick up Senator McCain.
Congressman McCain.
Congressman McCain. Okay. Thank you. And Marv wasn't going to take that ride himself. Was Marv on the river trip?
Yeah. Yeah, Marv, I'm pretty sure the Superintendent Marks would have been on that river trip, too. When a congressman showed up,
yep,
the superintendent goes.
All right. Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised if Regional Director Chapman went on that trip.
Ah, okay.
Because it was obviously a trip to discuss policy with the congressman. And, yeah, so I just don't have a clear recollection of who all was on that trip.
Okay. But that definitely was, I'm assuming that would have been an eye-opener to you to see that connection.
Mm-hmm. You're all young Buck Ranger at the time.
Hmm. Well, you mentioned that you were head of the river unit, and there had been a reorganization of the unit by Superintendent Marks, that you weren't real keen on. And it sounds like in 1984 you were thinking about maybe moving to another job.
Yeah. I was looking to move on. And a fellow by the name of John Reynolds showed up for a river trip.
R-E-Y-N-O-L-D-S?
Yeah.
Okay.
John Reynolds. He was the deputy regional director, I think, at the time. Might have been the regional director. But I think he was the deputy regional director at the time.
Okay.
Yeah. And he had recently become the superintendent of North Cascades. What particular reason he was on the river trip, I'm not sure. Something to do with the regional implementation of policy, I'm sure.
Okay.
So he showed up to take a river trip. And at the concurrently, there had been a vacancy announcement for the Skehekin Unit Manager position, which is on the east side of the North Cascades.
How do you spell that?
Skehekin is S-T-E-H-E-K-I-N. Supposedly a Native American word for the way through or over the path.
Okay.
And that's how they got over the pass from the east side to the west side. One of the ways.
Okay.
Through the Skehekin Valley. So, I met him and chatted for a bit. And turns out, I think he spent a week on these partial trips. And during that time, he interviewed the boatman on the trip about Kurt Sauer.
Okay.
And so he got off the trip and back to the park. Maybe he was actually just transferring from the regional office up to the park.
Hmm.
And made a job offer for me to become the Stehekin unit manager, which I accepted in December of 1983, when my son was three months old. So we, movers packed up our household and we sold the Volkswagen bus, drove up there in a 1982 Subaru Outback, first of three Outbacks that I owned, and my wife, Tom Connor, drove the Carmagia, and I drove the Subaru. We got both cars up there, and we got the kid up there, and it was cold. So it was probably a week before Christmas.
Cold and damp?
Mostly cold.
Okay.
So we showed up at, I think, Woodrow Willie? Forget the name of the town where the headquarters was, Cedar Woolley, and spent a day there getting oriented, and John drove with us over to Lake Chelan, and Stehekin is located at the head of a 55-mile-long lake.
Wow.
And there are no roads into Stehekin. You either get there by, at that time, it was a 3-hour boat ride. Steaming up to 55 miles of lake.
Wow.
They flew in on a float plane.
Okay.
So that night in Stehekin in Chelan, it was about 20 degrees.
Ooh.
And the hotel we stayed in, the radiators weren't working. So I remember stuffing some wool socks into certain cracks, and we didn't get much sleep.
Hmm.
But we had the kid in between us, and the next morning we get up and we grab breakfast and we get on the boat, and it had one heater.
Ooh.
And there were probably 15 people on the boat. And we all took turns rotating in front of the heater.
So Kurt, 3 hours. Who was on the boat? 15 people. Were these all park people, or were these? Was this a community where people were living, and it was the locals going in too?
It was a community where people were living, and the locals were going in.
Okay.
And that's the way you either you paid Jim Courtney to fly in his float plane, or you paid the boat company, and. Most of them used the boat because it was less expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So, I chatted with some of the locals on the boat ride and tried to keep the kid warm. I got off the dock and walked over to the house, which was 100 yards from the marina. And the house was full of all of our boxes. And we opened the refrigerator, and the refrigerator was full of food.
Wow.
That had been prepared by the local community.
Oh.
And that's the type of community that it was. If you needed help, people showed up. If you wanted to borrow a truck, go cut your firewood, people loaned you a truck. So it was a real eye-opening experience moving from Grand Canyon with a visitation of 3 million at the time, with just hordes of visitors, to Stehekin in the winter. And I could go on and on and on about Stehekin, but the community was wonderfully warm. As long as I was not on duty as the Stehekin unit manager, but it was an interesting time. Where do you start? They very protective of the family. Connor learned to card wool and spin on a spinning wheel. There was a place called the Buckner Orchard, which the Buckner family had been homesteaders.
Is that B-U-C-K-N-E-R?
Yeah.
Okay.
And every fall, there was an apple cider pressing, community apple cider pressing.
Wow.
And everybody came together, and there was no discussion of Park Service policy.
Nice.
During that apple cider pressing and potluck, which lasted all day. So, just a real tight-knit, they supported each other.
Uh-huh.
When they needed to. And the Courtney family was a homesteading family. Hazel Imus was the surviving widow of Mr. Imus.
How do you spell her name?
I-M-U-S.
What was her first name?
Hazel.
Hazel. Thank you.
So, I got off the boat, had a refrigerator full of casserole, various other foods, which made sense because the way you got your groceries in Stehekin was you made out your shopping list, your food shopping list, and you put it in an envelope with a blank signed check, and you mailed it to the Safeway store in Chelan.
Wow.
And the Safeway staff did the shopping for everybody in Stehekin that placed their orders that way. And then they boxed everything up, took it over to the Lake Chelan Boat Company. Lake Chelan Boat Company put it on the boats, and you went down to the dock and got your groceries. So in the winter, the boat ran on Wednesdays and Saturdays. And that's when the mail came, on Wednesdays and Saturdays. So everybody lived up valley, as we called it. And there were 75 year-round residents.
Okay.
There were no telephones, except for one telephone, several telephones in the Park Service office. And the policy was that you could not use the phone unless it was an emergency. And that's a policy that the locals established.
Okay.
There was, I think at the time, two large satellite dishes. Hazel Imus watched her television during the day, and she would stare out the window. It looked like she was staring out the window. The telephone and the TV reception was so bad that the screen had all kinds of snow on it.
Right.
And she had discovered long ago that if she looked at the reflection in the window pane of the television, the snow went away.
Oh, wow.
So she would watch TV by looking at the reflection in the window, all of the cars were from the 60s and 70s, 50s. Tom Courtney was the main mechanic. Tom Courtney ran a landing craft to shuttle cargo for his family, and they had the Courtney Ranch, which was a dude ranch. So Imus family, the Courtney family, were all homesteaders, homesteader families. And we had a staff of about five or six employees. Maybe 10 employees, counting all of the seasonal maintenance workers.
Okay.
So we maintained the 7 miles of road, of which about 2 miles was paved. The rest of it was dirt. And basically that was the town.
Where did the road go?
It went up valley, and actually the road at the time went all the way up to the base of Stehekin Pass.
Okay.
Forget the name of the waterfall, but it went. It went along. I wouldn't say it was a cliff face, but it was a pretty narrow one-lane road. And that after I left, that there was a big storm, and that waterfall turned into a large waterfall and washed out the road. And you know, the North Cascades Complex was created in the 60s, and there was a big shift in the way the federal government was managing the area, because prior to the North Cascades Act, Stehekin had been in Forest Service land, which is a multiple-use agency. So up until that point, if you needed river gravel for some project, you went down to the river and got it.
Dug it up.
If you needed firewood, you went out wherever you wanted, and you cut the trees that you needed for your firewood. And that was the way that everybody heated, because electricity was too expensive. The electricity was a hydro unit that the electrical company had put in probably in the 50s. Old and antiquated. So
when the Forest Service transitioned the land to the Park Service under a different non-impairment mandate, I can see that probably didn't go over real well with the locals.
Did not go over at all.
Okay.
And I walked into a buzzsaw.
Did you have a clue that was happening before you showed up, or did John say, well, gee, I'm the new superintendent here, and this guy Sauer sounds like a good guy, so I'll bring him along as well? Did you have a clue that this was happening?
No.
Okay.
I had no clue. All I knew was that you got into Stehekin by boat or airplane, and there were some management issues that, you know, couldn't have been worse than the river management plan. The difference was that you lived in the valley, and pretty much anything that we tried to implement was opposed. Firewood management plan, gravel extraction, it all had limits on what you could take, and that was not accepted by the longtime local.
Yeah.
Now, there were a few folks that understood what we were trying to do, but they were not very vocal. I spent 3 years there. And had a great time. I mean, we could walk out the house and walk across the road. and walk up the hill 300 feet and be in wilderness.
Wow.
That was the first time that I saw a grizzly bear track up on the north end of the Stehekin unit out on patrol one day. And patrol that day, I rode with Phil, head of the trail crew, with his horses, and met the Washington chapter of the Backcountry Horsemen's Association, because they wanted to increase the amount of commercial activity and rides, and were not happy with the level of trail maintenance. So we rode up and met them, and first thing that the leader of the group said was something to the effect of, "We are very surprised to see that you are on a horse."
Okay.
Because apparently the previous managers had not been horse people.
Okay.
And remember when we were talking about Rocky Mountain National Park, George Wagner, that is Stehekin, and that's where George was in the 60s.
Oh, interesting.
Before he came to Rocky Mountain.
Okay.
So, that was an interesting twist for me when I got there and read some of the historical records and George Wagner's name was on them. So, yeah, just a beautiful, beautiful area. And, interesting people. They were interested in keeping Stehekin. In fact, another interesting story to me anyway is that was the time that VHS tapes were out and video cassette players were on the market.
Yep.
And I had some friends that taped Sesame Street for my son.
Oh, wow.
And the Denver Bronco football games. So I brought, I'd wait for the mail, and there'd be a VHS tape or two in the mail. And Sesame Street was one of them. And interestingly, in the one-room schoolhouse, which went all the way through the eighth grade, I think there were about 12 students. Most of them five or six of them were the same age group as Cubby.
Okay.
As my son, Damien. So word got out that we had purchased a VHR. Is that what they're called?
VHS? VHS player or a videotape player?
Yeah.
Wow.
And Connor would have play day, and all of these six or seven kids that were all about the same age would come down to the house and watch Sesame Street and then go play or go for a hike at Buckner Orchard or go for a hike in the woods.
Cool.
And half the people didn't believe that I should have a VHS player. They were opposed to satellite TVs, etc. And of course, that has all changed now with the cell phones and satellite TV.
Right. So the half the folks that didn't want the VHS, were they the same or different group that was uncomfortable with regulations on firewood collection and gravel mining?
Well, some of them were the same group, and some of them were different.
Okay, that would make sense. All right.
Interestingly, the Courtney family, Tom Courtney's wife and my wife, became pretty good friends through spinning of wool and other get-togethers of that little group of women. Tom Courtney was opposed to the regulations restricting use, but his wife was more interested in being a mom. In fact, she never, to the best of my knowledge, she never came to a public meeting. As Virgil's wife, the head of maintenance, never came to a public meeting. They just, they refused to get involved in politics of management of the park because it it could tear the community apart. And they wanted nothing to do with it.
Interesting.
So it was mostly the husbands. And the wives were more interested in the daily lives, especially the ones that had children.
Right.
So, yeah, it's it was an interesting time.
How did, you know, you mentioned going from 3 million people at the Grand Canyon to a small town with 75 folks or so. How did the tourist flow come to the park? Were people hiking over the saddle? Were they boating in? Were they flying in? Were they backpacking? What was the typical visitor experience like?
The typical visitor experience was a day trip. People would come up on the boat. They'd arrive about noon, and they would leave about, I don't know, 4 o'clock.
Okay.
So they had 4 hours. They'd hang out around the landing, go for a walk down lake, come back up, get on a shuttle bus, which the Park Service ran, go up valley, go for a short hike, maybe stay overnight. There were some rental cabins and lodge at the landing, the Lake Chelan Lodge, maybe not, I don't remember the name of it, had, I don't know, 10 rooms. So most of the folks would come for the boat ride, and then they'd look around. And we had the visitor center, which was an old dormitory with a huge downstairs open area, and it was the community building, one of the two community buildings, as well as Park Service Visitor Center. And a lot of the people that lived there were craftspeople, and so they would sell their wares in the visitor center. As something else for the tourists to do, and as a way of increasing their revenue.
Yep.
So, some, you know, Pacific Crest Trail runs through Stehekin. So there were several folks from the Pacific Crest Trail that would overnight there. And then, you know, a few people that chose to would fly in on Jim Courtney's float plane. And actually, there was another company there that I think Jim ended up buying out. He was a pilot for that company, and then the owners decided they'd sell, and I think he bought that company. I'm not sure how that all worked. And so that was, you know, there were one or two float planes that would land occasionally, every day. It certainly wasn't every half hour like Grand Canyon helicopter over scenic overflights.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was the summer season. Winter season, there were very few visitors. And you either came in and stayed overnight or stayed the weekend, or you just got on the boat for the boat ride. And it's like going up a fjord. It's 55 miles long, maybe a mile wide lake. and it's just gorgeous.
Wow.
And actually, you could drive your car 25 miles up the lake to Field Point and get on there as well, so you only had half of the time spent on the boats, which I think a lot of people did. A lot, and by a lot of people, I mean the Field Point boat launch area had a parking lot that held about 25 cars.
Did you bring your vehicles over there?
Yeah, we brought our vehicles in.
Okay.
They came up on Tom Courtney, and I mentioned he had a landing craft. He also had a barge.
Okay.
And that's how the moving truck and our vehicles got it. Well, one of our vehicles got into Stehekin. And in the summertime, the lake was full. And in the wintertime, the lake was down a good 10, 15 feet. So the barge landing in the wintertime was always interesting.
Hmm.
Fortunately, we weren't there to watch them unload our moving van. But we were there to watch them load it. And it was in the fall, early winter, and a very precarious situation. But Tom was pretty much a master of everything that he tried to do. So we got the moving van on the barge and took it out. And it was best that my wife not watch when that moving van was loaded.
You mentioned a firewood management plan, a gravel management plan. Had these things been written, or was that part of your job was to write these things?
No, that's part of my job to write them.
Oh, boy.
And I had a fellow by the name of, which will come to me in a minute, who was a resource management specialist.
Okay.
And he didn't work for me. He was stationed there. He worked for a fellow by the name of John Jarvis.
Okay.
Who was chief of resource management at North Cascades at the time that I was there. He later became the regional director and was the longest serving regional director since Russ Dickinson.
And
he was in for 12 years.
And then became the director for a little while, didn't he, before he retired?
Yeah, he was the director of the National Park Service for 12 years.
Okay.
For a long period of time, surviving two or three different administrations.
Yeah. And he was working on the west side with John Reynolds.
Right.
In headquarters there.
Right.
So you had a resource management specialist. You also had to deal with, a horse packing plan, as you mentioned, the Washington backcountry horseman.
Right.
So
Jim Hammett was the resource management specialist.
How do you spell his last name?
Hammett.
Okay.
And he was the primary author of the firewood management plan, which took us a couple of years of public meetings and John Reynolds running cover for us and running the offense on the outside. So that finally got implemented. And, it was a compromise. Everybody still had enough firewood, but there were certain areas that you could cut. These firewood plots would rotate over the years.
Okay.
So basically, we were thinning the forest.
Yeah.
And people didn't want to thin the small trees. They wanted to thin the larger trees. Because it's a lot easier to cut up a 5 or 6 foot diameter tree. Buck it up and take it home and split it than it is to cut up a bunch of small little toothpick trees.
Right.
As they were referred to in one meeting.
Well, that kind of landed you in a little fascinating journey there with the need to write contentious management plans. I mean, in a way, it sounded really good that you actually lived and rubbed shoulders with the community there. I think oftentimes I kind of wonder about that, places like Grand Canyon, where a lot of employees live in the park and they don't rub shoulders with the postman and the you know, the person that manages the city bus. And that sense of community is a little different.
Yeah, it's a little skewed.
Yeah.
Yeah, on the south rim of the Grand Canyon, probably the higher-ups in administration, over at headquarters, they had friends that were concessioners,
mm-hmm.
but the Rangers didn't rub shoulders with the concession employees.
Right.
You just didn't, because next week you'd end up arresting them.
Right.
So that wasn't the case in Skagen. Rub shoulders with everybody. Tom Courtney and I took a backcountry, cross-country ski trip overnight up to one of the cabins. Both of us making an effort to improve communications between both sides. The postmaster at the time was a ardent right-wing federal government shouldn't exist type person, which I always thought was highly ironic that he was making his living as a federal employee and he couldn't stand the federal government. No. Little, all kinds of twists like
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Can...
I mean, I would assume that at least that attempt to try to communicate would have been very well received instead of a simple stonewall.
Yeah, it's at least we can understand each other's views.
Right.
And I had some policies that needed to be followed, and they had some opinions that needed to be followed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was Skagen. I have an interesting story about why I left, if you want to hear it.
Please.
By the way, I mentioned a fellow by the name of Richard Hansen.
Yes.
At the time that I went to Skagen, he had left Grand Canyon and was the trail crew foreman in Olympic National Park.
Huh.
And so I called him for the job. And he said, "Oh, yes, Skagen's a beautiful place. It's only like an hour and a half from here. And, you know, just come out on the weekends and come on over and we'll go fishing."
Hmm.
I said, "Okay, great." Well, when I got there, I figured out that it was a half-hour float plane ride or a 3 or 4 hour boat ride to get down lake. And then it was a 4 hour drive over the divide to get to Seattle and then take a ferry, go out on the peninsula and get to Port Angeles, Washington. So, anyway, at the time, he was at Olympic National Park, and he was good friends with Superintendent Bob Chandler. Turns out Bob Chandler and John Reynolds were super friends. I think they'd been together at Santa Monica National Recreation Area when it was created. So John had become the superintendent of North Cascades. Bob was the superintendent of Olympic National Park.
Okay.
And one of the other issues up there was in Stehekin there was an airstrip that had been closed, and we wanted to permanently close the airstrip. Hindsight, probably would have been better to just leave it alone. So we decided we'd take some actions to close the airstrip, and that brought all kinds of pushback from the aviation enthusiasts. And somehow or another, in that group, was a fellow that liked to fly in and liked to go hunting in the fall. And I can't remember his name, which is surprising, because I certainly remembered his name at the time. So anyway, he would fly in, land at the airstrip, bring his buddies with him. And one year he was out hunting, and I went into his camp and told him I wanted to check his hunting license. And he was like, "I'm not showing you my hunting license. You're a federal agent. You don't have any authority here." I said, "Okay." We'll leave it at that. And he had flown out the following day when I went back to camp, and his son was there. His son wasn't as well versed in the conversations that he had perfected. So I ended up figuring out who he was. I said it was Eddie, but I can't remember the name. It'll come to me. Anyway, I ended up when he came back in, I ended up giving him a citation for illegal hunting. And you could hunt in the national recreation area. Stehekin was a national recreation area. There's two national recreation areas in North Cascades National Park complex.
Okay.
There's North Cascades National Park. On the east side is Stehekin National Recreation Area, or the Lake Chelan National Recreation Area. And on the west side is another national recreation area. So you can hunt in the national recreation areas.
Yep.
Following state and park service guidance.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up giving this fellow a citation for illegal hunting.
In the park?
In the recreation area.
In the recreation area, okay.
Yeah. I don't remember exactly what I cited him for.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And he refused to pay the ticket and decided he would go to district court in Spokane. So I had to go over to Spokane and the day before I met with the attorneys. And, I just walked in and went to the attorney's offices. Had my meeting, went home to the hotel. The next morning, I come back in uniform, and I walk into the courthouse, and there are three metal detectors that have been installed.
Ooh.
And I went, what? Something's not right. So I went through the metal detectors and went to the attorney's office, and I said, what's with the metal detectors? And they looked at me and said, "Do you know who this guy is that you cited?" "Nope. I know his name. I don't know anything about him other than he was hunting illegal."
Mm-hmm.
"Yeah, well, he is associated with the Aryan Brotherhood."
"Oh."
"And he is one of their survival training instructors. And he is going to be accompanied into court by a bunch of his associates. So there are metal detectors so that we can prevent them from bringing weapons in your courtroom." After I picked myself up off the floor, "Oh, great." So we went into court, and he represented himself, and I was on the stand, and he said, you know, if you'd been a state game warden, I would have shown you my hunting license. I said, well, I am a state game warden. And his mouth dropped and said, you are? I said, yeah. Reached in my pocket and pulled out my commission from the state game, handed it to the judge so he could read it and say, yeah, he's a state game warden, deputy. I think his name was Ed. Ed's argument kind of went out the window because he said, well, how come you didn't show me your state game credentials? I said, well, I wasn't acting as a state game officer. I was acting as a federal law enforcement officer. Anyway, he ended up getting convicted and was sentenced to pay a $500 fine. And the judge said, and you will pay it before you are released from this court.
Ooh.
And he nodded to the federal marshals, there were about eight of them in the courtroom, and they walked up, and Ed said, I don't have any money, hold on a second. And he turned around, and the people in the courtroom that were there to support him dug into their wallets and came up with $500, otherwise he was going to be held pending bail. So he was convicted, and it was the following week when he showed up on the front steps of my house where my wife and son lived, with two of his associates, and he served me papers into the Freemason Court.
I've never heard, okay.
So, the Freeman's Court, yeah, Freeman's Court.
Okay.
Which is some court system that these folks have alleged is valid, and the federal court system is not. Hmm. So, I went down to the office. It was on a Saturday. Called John Reynolds, the superintendent, and said, okay, this guy just showed up on my porch, armed, threatening, in my opinion, threatening the security of my wife and son. I'm the only law enforcement officer here. The sheriff's response time is at least 2 hours, unless they come in by plane. You need to move me. You need to move my family. And I'm not putting up with it. So, following Monday, I called the U.S. attorney. He said, don't worry about it. We'll take care of the charges. It's in the Freeman's Court. It's bogus. And John Reynolds made a call to Bob Chandler. Basically, said, we got to move Kurt because of the potential threat to his family. So in a month's time, I had a job at Olympic National Park as the East District Ranger. Never applied for the job. I went over for an interview, met with the chief ranger. Chief Ranger decided he didn't want to hire me. Told the superintendent that, no, I'm not going to hire Kurt. The superintendent, Bob Chandler, said, yes, you are going to hire him. And we were out of there within 2 months.
Wow.
Over at Olympic National Park. So, we had a going away party, which the community threw for us at Buckner Orchard, complete with huge cake that had been made by the local baker, local baker's wife, who was another Courtney who hated the Park Service. But But the community had always respected our family and always taken care of our son, and my wife. And they had integrated into the community very well. And we had another community potluck at the Buck Orchard. It was the going away party. Well, this is a strange place to live. Wonderful people.
Yeah.
And certain groups of them are associated with other people that aren't good people on both sides.
Yeah. Wow, that's you know, it's, you think about it. And it's just like, all right, well, the next Park Service employee has to come in and integrate or not with the community is going to face the same threats again. You think, gee, you know, we hope we just outlive these people in the next 100 years to help them come around to a non-impairment vision of resource protection.
Yeah, and I have no idea what the current situation is. I joked with one of the school teacher and his wife were ardent activists against the Park Service, and I joked with her one time about, well, you know, I might just come back and be superintendent here. And she said, I certainly hope not. Well, one of my seasonal rangers at the time, 15 years later, came back as superintendent of North Cascades National Park Service Complex.
Hmm.
And he was dealing with the same issues 15 years later.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, that was Stehekin. It's a wonderful place and wonderful people. But multiple use versus limited use is a very contentious issue there. Yeah, much more contentious than the river unit management, the river management plan.
Well, it's interesting thinking about a complex that has a recreation area in it and a park in it, or multiple parks, multiple recreation areas. There's a huge educational effort that needs to be done to educate the public about the differences between those jurisdictional mm-hmm. areas and how they're managed and why they're managed differently.
And the politics that went into getting the North Cascades National Park legislation and the give and take of, okay, we'll make this part of it a national recreation area and this will be allowed, and this part over here that we're expanding and taking away from the Forest Service will be managed differently. And then not only educating the locals that live there, but educating the employees.
Right.
Because many of them, myself included, had come from a national park background. And now you have a national recreation area.
Right.
Where you can hunt. Can't trap, but you can hunt.
Uh-huh.
And you can fish in both the park and recreation area the same way under state guidelines.
Right.
So, yeah, it was an eye-opener.
Yeah, and that's you know, Grand Canyon National Park sandwiched between Glen Canyon National Recreation Area upstream and Lake Mead National Recreation Area downstream.
Mm-hmm.
And those regulations are different. And there's a reason why. So, yeah. So, Richard Hansen is at Olympic, and now you're going to Olympic. So this is going to be good. Okay. You know, we've been happily yik-yakking for about an hour here. Maybe this is a good place to put in a comma, and we'll pick up your journey to Olympic next time we talk. What do you think?
Sounds like a plan.
Okay. Well, then, in that case, we'll go ahead and wrap up this Part 7 Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Kurt Sauer. My name is Tom Martin. Today is October 14th, 2020. And, Kurt, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.